Good morning. Well, it has been a whirlwind of a week, with almost every single day throwing up some class of controversy. But where to begin? Well, let's go here, and the class of 2020.
On behalf of the Department of Education and Skills, I want to apologise sincerely to our Leaving Certificate students for the situation we are now in and for the upset it will cause. I want to acknowledge that students have had an exceptionally difficult year. They don't need this upset and dismay.
They certainly don't, but by dad, they got it. That was Minister for Education, Norma Foley, at around about 4:15 on Wednesday. Because just before lunchtime that same day, a question in the Dáil from Labour's Alan Kelly led the Taoiseach to admit there had been some coding errors for this year's calculated grades for the Leaving Cert. Just a line, mind you, but quite the error. At 1:45, Joe opened up the fader.
Well, the Department of Government and all those who supported this idea of calculated grades and the algorithm need not go too far in their dictionary this afternoon to look for a word that describes what's happened to Leaving Cert students. It begins with C and it ends with K, unfortunately. And anyone listening to Liveline over the last 6 months would have seen this coming, because the Department of Education have now revealed that 6,000 students, that's 10% of the Leaving Cert cohort this year, 6,000 students were incorrectly, wrongly, mistakenly downgraded in their calculated points.
And when that monumental error was corrected, it left some 1,000 students now entitled to a college course that they had previously been told they'd failed to attain. And bear in mind, college started this week.
The department gave me 510. They reduced me in 6 subjects and they took a total of 45 points.
And that knocked you out from the course of your choice.
Personally, Joe, I'm really hoping that I'm in that percentage, because some of the reductions were absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I got 443 points this year and found out that my teachers gave me 44 points higher, which would have had me at 487.
Brilliant.
96% of students in my school got downgraded by at least one grade.
Wow. Amy, did anyone get upgraded?
Nope. Not that I've heard of.
And what, can't you want to tell me the name of your school?
The Institute of Education.
Me and my identical twin brother. We were both awarded 625 points by the school.
Right.
But one of us was downgraded. It was me. I was downgraded in 2 of my subjects.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, because it just feels so random that both of us were awarded the full whack, but only I was downgraded.
And did you miss out because you were downgraded, Aaron?
I did. I missed out on medicine. So now I'm studying biomedical science. Feeling fairly robbed, but I'm hoping I'm one of the 6,000 now. If they do upgrade me, I'll be given it a fair place. I don't mind waiting the year. If they give it to me, I don't mind actually waiting the year.
Oh, do you not?
But I just feel so random. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm one of the lucky ones that I have a course. Like, if I hadn't got the points for primary school, my 5th and 6th choice were higher than my 5 or 7. I would have been gone. I would have been doing nothing. I am so lucky in that regard. Like, it broke my parents' hearts. It really did. And it broke my heart to see him so upset. The day I got my results, like, my father was convinced I wouldn't get any CAO offers. He was convinced. He didn't sleep for days before the CAO results came out. My grandparents, in absolute bits. Because they know how hard I worked for them 2 years. I worked my absolute socks off, Joe.
Some of the voices on Liveline, courtesy of Morning Ireland, and upset and dismay doesn't even begin to cover it. Well, later on Drive Time, Guidance Counsellor Brian Mooney joined Sarah and Cormac, and very quickly it became apparent that this was a case of numbers, resources and space, or rather, the lack thereof.
What are the repercussions of this? Say, if I wanted to do medicine,
yes,
and I lost out on this, and now I realise, well, hang on, this could be why I've lost out.
Correct.
So, medicine is full in most colleges, if not all.
Yes.
So what happens if I have achieved the result as a result of this? Will I be stuffed into a medicine course, or is there space?
Here's the situation. We had a problem by virtue of the fact that there were thousands of students who had done the Leaving Cert in previous years. And they were obviously going to have less good results than this year's group because we already knew that there was a 4.4% grade inflation built into this year's. And if you looked at it at higher level, it was up to 10%. So effectively, people coming in from previous years was at a disadvantage before we even started.
Mm.
To try and counter that, the minister created 1,400 additional places, which was under an initiative on technology and science, and then created several thousand other places, which Minister Harris agreed to fund through the HEA, which basically the college said, where could we find a square inch to stuff another student? And all of those were filled.
Aye, aye, aye. Well, the next morning, Minister for Education Norma Foley joined Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland.
The question is, with the colleges, third level colleges already 2,000 up on last year, where would those extra 1,000 students be fitted in?
Well, I think, and again, I will say that that's just an estimate or a guesstimate at this stage. But what I will say, there is an absolute commitment, and I want to acknowledge that from Minister Harris and indeed from my own department, that we will work hand in hand to do all that we possibly can to ensure that all students who are to get an upgraded offer will receive that offer and the maximum number of them to be able to follow that up in this academic year.
All that you possibly can isn't going to build laboratories where there's a limit on the number of laboratories and so on, and, you know, isn't going to be able to squeeze extra people onto a medical course where there's a natural limit on the number of people who can do that course successfully. So there will be people who'll have to wait, won't there?
There may well be a number of students who have to defer, but I have to say it is very early to make that call now. I think we have to acknowledge that huge efforts were already made this year in terms of making extra places available. Equally, we have to acknowledge that there is an absolute intention from all concerned, my own department, to work hand in hand with the Department of Higher Education to ensure a maximum number of places will be available. And I have confidence that we will achieve that to the absolute limit.
Ooh, I sense a prefab been rustled up someplace. And the financial cost of all of this is estimated at some 10 million euro. Take it away, Áine.
And who will pay for this mess, either politically or administratively or financially?
Well, there is, you know, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge an error has occurred. That error is being rectified. All that needs to be done is being done. I think the fact that, you know, you would regard it as a mess, absolutely, it is. You know, I would regard it as unacceptable that it happened, but it would be a true mess if no action and no positive and proactive action were being taken. And I think it's important to acknowledge that action is being taken. It is important to acknowledge that we are doing all that we can to right what has occurred for our students. And I do want to take the opportunity to apologise to the class of 2020, who I know have gone through so much in this past number of months. And I want to acknowledge that. I want to acknowledge that they did not need this additional stress and anxiety, if you like. But I want to assure them that all that needs to be done is being done, and it has been done as speedily as possible.
Minister Norma Foley on Thursday's Morning Ireland, and questions remain, quite a few in fact, particularly around the selection of the company Polymetrica. Here's Cormac and Barry Linehan on Thursday's Drive Time.
One line of code going wrong, but questions being asked, how did Polymetrica get the contract to do this work? How was it selected by government? Was there an open tender public procurement process? Was it in accordance with EU law? Was a tender document submitted by Polymetrica? And what due diligence was done by the department on this company before this historic deal?
And what's the Department of Education saying this evening now?
Well, in a statement just to hand from the Department of Education, it has confirmed that there was no normal full procurement process to give the contract for the calculated grades code to Polymetrica, citing insufficient time. It went on to say that the department availed of a procurement process known as the negotiated procedure without prior publication, which according to the government's public procurement guidelines is allowed to be used in cases of extreme urgency. It also goes on to defend Polymetrica and Mr. Cartwright, but says that the Education Research Centre carried out a number of checks of the code. However, Mr. Cartwright does have associates, links to that centre. Another company, a US-based ETS Educational Testing Service, now looking at the code to see if it's right a second time. But that company has attracted controversy in the UK over grading there. So the government will hope no more controversy ahead.
Oh, I'd say they're huddled in the fetal position, clutching their calculators and beseeching the gods. And that's just the government. Never mind the poor students. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Small but perfectly formed, the short story was dissected on Arena during the week. On Monday, Sean was joined by writers Nuala O'Connor and Thomas Morris. And Sean started off with something of a literary Sophie's Choice.
People often set this idea of the short story versus the novel, a kind of conflict. Is that even a fair fight? You know, which of your children do you like best? Which do you like best, apples or oranges?
I think it so often comes down to personal preference. And I think it probably does the short story for me a disservice to be constantly comparing it to the novel. I think they can do such different things. But I'm also kind of wary of being prescriptive about what a short story does. I think so often writers are very keen to say a short story does this, whereas a novel does that. And quite often they're just describing their own writing.
And Nuala O'Connor dismissed any idea that the short story was in some way the poor relation.
They are their own art. They're not a big poem and they're not a small novel. And just because they're small doesn't mean they're minor. Basically, I suppose a short story is a small slice of time where things are going wrong for someone. So we're meeting the characters now because something has or is about to change for them. They're in trouble or it's about to begin. So things are going wrong, but they may yet go right. So there is room for all of that, you know, joy and love and, you know, disaster as well. It's a very malleable form. Mm. It's elusive. It's difficult to pin down. You know, a lot goes into a short story and something very condensed and rich comes out.
Elusive, says Nuala O'Connor. But back to Thomas Morris. Now, while he didn't want to get too prescriptive, he was willing to offer this nugget by way of short story master George Saunders.
He talked about the short story as a place of persuasion. And he said to imagine that the reader is a friend who's going to leave town. And as a writer, you've got at your disposal any tool that you want to pick in order to persuade them to stay. Mm. And you can use humour, you can use seriousness, you can use charm. But basically, you can do anything just to keep them there.
Well, that's such a great way of thinking of the short story. And on Wednesday, Sinead Gleeson came in to Sean and she explained why the title of the short story anthology she had edited is called The Art of the Glimpse.
When you say The Art of the Glimpse, I'm remembering, yeah. I think it was Claire Keegan at some stage I heard speaking about the short story and about this idea of an arc, you know, yeah. And if you had a big bow, the short story is just from, you know, just at the point where the bow turns around. That's yeah. the bit that you're capturing.
That's it.
Where does that title, The Art of the Glimpse,
well,
come from?
Well, it's funny. It actually comes from one writer in the book talking about another writer in the book. And the writer who said it is obviously a master of the short story and very well known to people, who's William Trevor, who's you know, I actually prefer his short stories to the novels. And he wrote an introduction to quite an obscure writer called Margaret Barrington. She was born in Mallon and Donegal. I featured her in The Glass Shore. And he was married to Liam O'Flaherty, who's also in the book. And he wrote the introduction to her only collection. She only wrote one collection of short stories, published 5 months after her death in 1982 with Wolfhound Press, I think. And he said that her gift for the short story was her gift for the art of the glimpse. And when I hear that phrase, I think of it as like looking through the chink of a door and only getting part of a scene. You don't get the start and the end. Maybe you might get the middle.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of these stories, that's what the possibility of the short story is. It can only, you know, it's 3,000 words, it's 10 or 12 pages. You're in somebody's head with a set of characters and a specific space for that short a period of time. So you have to make it count. And in the short story, I think every word does count. And that's why they're so hard to do and they're so hard to get right, I think.
Sinead Gleeson with Sean, and coming back full circle to Monday's Arena when the Frances McManus short story competition winner was announced. 4,000 entries, a short list of 10, and then one overall winner. The story is called Flower Wild and it was written by Shane Tivenin. Its starting point is Violet Gibson, the would-be assassin of Mussolini. Here's how one of the judges, Vincent Woods, described her and the winning story.
Fascinating story. She was the daughter of Lord Ashburn, born in Merrion Square, would have known the wilds. Mm. And she's another, like Countess Markowitz, another of these aristocratic rebels. But it's not quite clear. She had a pot shot at Mussolini in Rome in March 1926.
Took the nose off.
It almost took the nose off him. She escaped a lynching. And because of her family influence, she was spared. She came back to England and spent the rest of her life in a famous psychiatric hospital in Northampton, mental hospital, where the story is set. And this story is fascinating in its exploration of the interior life of the woman. You know, it's not presenting her as a hero who tried to bring down the great dictator. It's much more subtle and complex.
Well, let's listen to a section, Flower Wild, the author Shane Tivenin, and the reader here, Ingrid Craigie.
I was taken here to Northampton after I shot the Italian. Il Duce, they used to call him. I shot him one morning in Rome and my bullet took the tip off his nose. I shot him when they were all still mesmerised by him. They'd sit around in the parks and walk the country lanes, idolising images of him. Il Duce, they would say to each other, long live Il Duce. I shot him many years before they shot him, before they lynched him, before they hung his dead body upside down from a street lamp and danced around below in celebration.
Flower Wild by Shane Tivenin, read by Ingrid Craigie, the winner of this year's Francis McManus Short Story Competition. On Thursday, Tom Vaughan Lawler spoke to Ray Darcy about his new film Rialto, and while Tom might be very happy to move on, to us, he'll always be Nidge.
And Nidge probably got you the part in the Marvel movies, did he?
I think probably there's a definite correlation between the two. I think yes. there was a knock-on effect. But then, like, I know plays I did that got me love. Hey,
yeah, so yes, it's all yes, a yes. trickle all connected. Effect. Yeah.
It's all connected, you know. It's all connected somewhere.
And speaking of plays, I didn't know this until I was reading up on you today, but you were after a part in a play in London you didn't specify in the article I read, by a writer you loved, a part you loved, you know, in a theatre you loved, all those things, and you didn't get it. And as a result, you were available to do Love Hate.
That's right. Well, that's, again, the actor's lot, is that sometimes something doesn't go your way and it's actually this incredible blessing and this incredible piece of good fortune. But yeah, I auditioned for a play in London that I really, really wanted, and I didn't get it, and I was pretty devastated. And then I was standing on the set of Love Hate and going, God, if I got that, I wouldn't be doing this. And then, you know, you look at your life, you go 3 years down the line, you go, my God, what a close call that was. But I suppose the revolving doors thing, one door opens, another door closes. You can drive yourself insane as an actor thinking, you know, what might have been here, what might have been there. And you just have to just let all that go, the good and the bad.
Oh, I feel there's a pearl of wisdom in there somewhere. Ray Darcy with Tom Vaughan Lawler. Now, while nobody really thought the first US presidential debate was going to be a masterclass in political discourse with policy front and centre, for it to sink as low as it did, well...
It's hard to get any word in with this clown. Excuse me, this
Hey, let me
person.
Just say to you.
Everything he's saying so far is simply a lie. I'm not here to call out his lies. Everybody knows he's a liar.
But you
I
agree.
Just want to make sure.
Joe, you're the liar.
I want to make sure.
You graduated last in your class, not first in your class.
God. Folks, do you have any idea what this clown's doing?
Call it Medicare for you have any idea?
Because the question is, the
radical left.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This Who's is on your so list? Right.
Gentlemen,
is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented. He's going to pack the
court. Here's how Gavin Jennings put it.
That's 30 seconds. Imagine 90 minutes of that.
Ain't that the truth? On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Gavin spoke to Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan.
Morning, Brian. A pretty chaotic affair. Debate rules seem to go out the window.
Absolutely, Gavin. It was a circus. It was a shambles. Minutes into the debate, Donald Trump started interrupting Joe Biden, and it carried on like that for pretty much the entire 90 minutes. The debate moderator, Chris Wallace of Fox News, he really struggled to keep this thing under control. At one point, he said he felt it was like Donald Trump was debating him rather than Joe Biden. And he reminded the US president that he had agreed to the rules of this debate. He said 2 minutes each for each candidate, uninterrupted, and then you can engage in that back and forth. But Donald Trump just repeatedly ignored those rules. Now, at the start, Joe Biden met these interruptions with laughs, smiles, sighs, eye rolls, but this quickly descended into utter frustration.
One step off hair pulling, and one other rather frightening moment stood out.
But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups, sure, and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
to
specifically
that,
do it?
Well, I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Hard to know what to say, really. Well, later on the same programme, Gavin spoke to Larry Donnelly, law lecturer in NUI Galway and former legal counsel of Democrats Abroad. And he also spoke to James Connor of Republicans Overseas Ireland. He put this to James.
James, when asked to condemn white supremacists, Donald Trump called them Proud Boys and called on them to stand back and stand by. Why do you think he did that?
The way that I heard it was stand back. I think stand back is I take that to mean the same as stand down, like stop what you're doing. Stand by is a simple term, like stand by, like don't go anywhere, because, I mean, like when I was in the military, it was stand by, man. Don't go anywhere because we got something for you to do.
Or be ready.
In the sense that if you guys don't stop acting up, we're going to, you know, deal with you accordingly. And then the president followed it up with, I think he said to condemn Antifa as well, because he is always getting lumped in with this extreme right, white supremacist thing. But there's never any talk about the extreme left with Antifa and the BLM movement and whatever anarchy groups are on that side.
Yes, but by failing to condemn right-wing activists in the same way that he condemned left-wing activists, he wouldn't have convinced many middle-ground voters, would he?
I don't think so, because if I remember correctly, he was on a roll about something, and then Chris had asked him, do you condemn it? And he said two or three times, yeah, yes, I'll condemn whoever you want. Who do you want? And then he put it out there. And then I think he threw it back to Vice President Biden to go ahead and condemn the opposing group. So it really wasn't equal in that sense. I feel that he did condemn them. He said, you want me to condemn them? Yes, there it is.
And then Joe Biden, not exactly covered in glory either.
There were low expectations, Larry Donnelly, of Joe Biden. Did he meet them or exceed them?
I think he probably met them at the end of the day. Joe Biden wasn't great. I mean, there were moments of weakness. There were moments where he was meandering. But I think at points he was solid. I think he was solid when it came to urging Americans to get out to vote. I think he was solid when he talked about we can be better than this, we can do better than this. But the bottom line here, Gavin, is that it was really a sad night for America, in my view. If you think back to presidential debates, at least during my lifetime, there was an element of decorum. There was an element of respect on both sides that I think always shone through. Last night, what we saw was personal attacks that I thought were nasty, biting back and forth, and didn't really contribute very much to people's understanding of the issues, or indeed did it move the needle very much. If anything, I think Donald Trump, because he was so aggressive and kept talking over people and kept trying to insert himself, he may have alienated some of that small group of persuadable voters that both candidates are fighting over.
Democrat supporter Larry Donnelly on Morning Ireland. However, we already know he likes us. And now he's back.
After that debate, do you think Matt Damon will stay here? Yeah.
Stay, Matty, stay. And all of that before yesterday's bombshell that President Trump and Melania Trump have both tested positive for COVID-19. This week, eh? On Thursday, Wynne Tubridy spoke to historian Gillian O'Brien about her book, The Darkness Echoing, which explored sites of massacre, famine and general historical black spots. And it was a much more engaging discussion than you might think from that intro. O'Brien, you see, wanted to learn more about those who were not history makers per se. No, she was more interested in the lives of those scribbled in the margins, the dispossessed even.
In museums, so many of the things, there are artefacts that are kept.
Yes.
And what's kept tends to be people who have money, who have things that do survive. So we don't really hear the story of people who didn't have things that were deemed worthy of collection or who didn't own things.
Yes.
And I found that I wanted to try and merge telling the story of those who had and the story of those who had not in as much as it was possible
to
do that.
So one of my favourites, I spoke about a lot, we talked about the famine earlier on in Strokestown, the Shard of Mirror, the little cracker, will you tell me about that?
Oh, this I found really moving. So in Strokestown, where they have the Famine Museum, there is, you know, amidst all the other things that are on display, there's this tiny shard of a mirror set in a frame. And underneath that, there's a list of sort of all of the things owned by a particular community in Donegal in, I think, 1837. It lists sort of a couple of mattresses, a couple of, you know, some farm implements and a number of things, all of which are really small in quantity for the number of people that there are.
Well, as we're listing, you know, 4,000 people owned one cart, one plough, 20 shovels, 32 rakes, 7 table forks, 93 chairs, 243 stools, two feather beds, 3 watches and 1 mirror. Guido, 1837.
Yeah, and it's a shard of a mirror.
Wow.
So, and you're thinking, they had no need. You know, this was, what they had was so little. And I just found that really moving because you get all the big figures. And I think somebody, the figures on the famine of, you know, is it 1 million emigrated or 1.5 million? Is it 1 million died or 1.5 million? That's just so huge. And then you go and see this one piece. And that, it's those small things that I always find the most moving, and because they're kind of personal.
And she was also keen to disabuse us of some much repeated historical truths.
But I think it's really important what we think we know, because that affects kind of how you act. And I remember being taught in school that Wolfe Tone had been killed by an English soldier.
Yeah.
And years later discovering that actually he had killed himself, like he'd cut his own throat. But we couldn't talk about that because at the time that would have been deemed a sin. Or Sir Walter Raleigh brought potatoes to Ireland. Everyone knows that. And apparently it's not true.
What? Wait a minute.
But
tobacco. And potatoes.
No potatoes. Other people brought the potatoes to Ireland. But I did discover, and I don't know if this is true, but I'm happy to believe it, that Cromwell soldiers brought cabbages.
Well, now, at least that they brought, somebody brought something.
Somebody brought something. I mean, they brought a whole lot of trouble, but they also apparently brought cabbages.
And you have other things. Queen Victoria gave £5 in famine aid.
She did, and some more. I mean, but
I thought it was about 200 or something. Was it 2,000?
It goes up to over 1,000, depending on how you calculate it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I mean, it's still not great.
Not really.
But I think the £5 always just seems so...
It was a lovely insult.
Yes, a lovely insult.
To keep going forever.
She noticed it was happening.
Yeah.
And thought, I'll throw them a fiver.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think there's something just sort of lovely about that.
Yeah, I bet that myth.
It's better that she gave a tiny amount than she gave nothing. Because you can make more of it. You can be more bitter about
it. Oh, you're fierce good to us. Sure, that fiver will go a long way. Gillian O'Brien on her book, The Darkness Echoing. Oh, and by the way, in a less than surprising move, the UK hasn't actually withdrawn their contentious and illegal internal market bill. Rule Britannia is now getting a rat-a-tat-tat in the post from the EU's Ursula von der Leyen.
The deadline lapsed yesterday. The problematic provisions have not been removed. Therefore, this morning, the Commission has decided to send a letter of formal notice to the UK government. This is the first step in an infringement procedure.
Don't make us say nidge over. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, it seems almost churlish to bring this up, given all that they're going through, but the start of the week was dominated by this. Eek, for Fraser's Week, Galway Spanish Arch, and yes, quite the gathering. And the reaction to this was perhaps indicative of the anger, frustration and despair people are feeling as we try valiantly to surf this second wave. Here's Jill with Joe.
What's the part that people didn't understand yet, after 6 months? After 6 months at home, like 6 months, and people are still reacting like that. Students, highly educated, right? So these are the same people that are going to run the country in a few years' time. Do you know what I mean? I can't accept that. Like, I am giving up enough a lot of my personal life, my professional life, because of this virus. And I am doing exactly as you said to be done. So my husband. So we are doing, and his family as well, we are doing everything to get out of this.
Liveline on Tuesday. And that anger simmered over the airwaves all day long. Earlier, Claire Byrne had spoken to Fianna Fáil Senator Ollie Crow, who suggested that maybe it was time for boots on the ground.
You know, as an army town here in Galway, we have the barracks in Renmore, and I've no doubt that the officers, you know, would stationed there would be willing to pitch in and assist the Gardaí if that was required.
And back to Liveline, where Dave had an idea.
A fire engine should have been brought in last night and hosed a whole lot of them down and let them go home wet.
Ooh, red hot anger off the wireless there. But on drive time later, John Cook went and spoke to students down in Galway, some of whom were remarkably sanguine about the whole affair.
I don't know how people didn't see this happening and think it was time to go home. Like, you can understand someone coming down for a good time, maybe seeing one or two friends, but when it got to out of control like it did, it was just ridiculous.
It'll definitely give us a bad name anyway. Like, regardless of what the outcome is, the students will get the blame.
Do you think it'll change behaviour? I mean, will there be nights out tonight, house parties, or, I mean, that was only Monday.
I mean, it's a hard thing to police, really. Like, you can shut the pubs and you can shut the nightclubs, but you can't go to every house. You know, so it's hard to control, really.
It's just people gathering around, having a few drinks and stuff. Yeah, there was nothing crazy. Like,
how many would you say?
I'm not too sure. Maybe about 100, maybe less. There was no large gatherings, though. It was kind of people in their own kind of.
People are saying it's more than that in the pictures, and I see signs saying a maximum of 15 people to gather here.
If you're coming down in your household, there should be no problem with you coming down and enjoying outside if you're in.
I don't think it was a household last
night. No, but like, people aren't intermingling between groups. Like, it was people were in around in pockets and stuff. It wasn't like one massive gathering. Yeah.
Do you think people are being hard on the students? You seem very defensive of what seemed to be a big festival type gathering.
No, I'm the other side of it. I think it was bad. Like,
John Cook for Drive Time in Galway. And later on Late Debate, Katie Hannan put this to Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Union of Students in Ireland.
Tell me, I think any student, I don't know if any students are listening to radio at this stage of their lives, but if they turned on any radio station or saw any media or went on social media today, that they would have, you know, basically felt like they were public enemy number one. What impact would that have? Would that just be water off a duck's back for people who were going to, who didn't really, are not that focused on the regulations anyway, or, you know, will that change behaviour? What impact will that have, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, like, every day is a day for us to be able to improve and better our behaviour in general, do you know? And I think that's something that we all need to bear in mind as well. I don't think that this will be water off a duck's back. I think there is an awful lot of concern out there around anxiety and stress and depression, and reports that USI conducted highlight those in extreme numbers across the student population. And that was pre-COVID. So the impact of lockdown and so on, the experts are all saying, has a disproportionate impacted young people because of our reliance on social interaction and the importance of that in part of our development and so on. So I do think that it has a major impact on people, and I don't think making the vast majority of students out to be public enemy number one is what's going to help us here. I think we need to engage with students and talk to students, and, as I say, go to students where they're at.
USI's Lorna Fitzpatrick, and this was a flavour of texts into Katie.
We're getting a huge reaction to this, actually, on the thing, a kind of a varied reaction. This is from a student. Classes online are a struggle. Lecturers barely know how to turn on the webcam and mic. We will struggle to get going and be educated. Lecturers weren't prepared. GMIT had 26-page COVID point plan to going back to campus. Now we are stuck at home. If we go to level 4 or 5, this is another texter, it will make no difference. The students have lost their jobs, lost the PUP payment and no longer on campus. We have nothing left to lose. The text line is great, but students need human contact. And another one saying, it's not fair to demand that students leave everyone they know and love behind and put them into a new city with no friends and then tell them not to socialise. It should not be online. It is not fair. I have classmates who are now have to pay upwards of €6,000 on rent and there are COVID clauses in place. And one final one, not quite as supportive. I was coming home through Galway City last night and the city centre and further out was thronged with loud young people loaded down with crates of alcohol and roaring and shouting. So spare us the sympathy for poor young people and stop watering things down. They are culpable, they are responsible, they are spoiled, they are utterly self-centred and contentious of our sick elderly and care workers.
Ooh, late debate on Tuesday night. But if Galway brought us sound and fury, it also brought us light and beauty. St Nicholas Church in the city centre is celebrating 700 years with a week of bell ringing. Here's the very Reverend Linda Pilo with Michael Cummin on The Leap of Faith.
The first bell was there, would you believe, since 1590. And then the other nine joined them. So there's a peal of 10 bells in 1891. So the ropes are no longer there. You can see the holes in the ceiling, but it is all connected in the bell tower. And we use pedals, a bit like a scale on a piano or a keyboard, although not quite the same. But nonetheless, so the bell ringers will actually push on the pedals or pound the pedals so that they chime in the bell tower.
Does it take a great deal of physical effort?
It takes a huge deal of physical effort. It really, really does. They're quite heavy to push down upon as well, but they make a fantastic sound.
The very beautiful bells of St Nicholas Church as heard on The Leap of Faith, and a very welcome interlude for the ear there. But try as we might, there's no getting away from the COVID. This week saw the global death toll from COVID-19 reach the 1 million mark. So how to live with it? Well, if possible, put on a big fat Gansey and head outdoors, because inside, the COVID doth linger. Here's Dr. Mike Osterholm, Director of the Centre for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And he gave Carol Coleman on the This Week programme a very useful analogy.
If you were here in this room that I'm in right now speaking to you on the phone, I'm creating this whole set of aerosols. It's these very small, tiny particles that float in the air that you don't see, but that surely contain the virus. If you want to understand an aerosol, think about the next time you're in a department store and you're four aisles away from the perfume section, you can still smell it. Mm. Or you're walking down the street and suddenly you smell cigarette smoke, and there you look up in front of you, 30 feet in front of you, is somebody walking and smoking a cigarette. Those are aerosols. When you're indoors, they concentrate in that room, and the air circulation often is insufficient to remove them quick enough. Or if you're outdoors, the air dissipates that, the movement of air, much more quickly. So outdoors is not 100% safe, but it's much, much safer than air indoors.
So bundle up and head out, it seems. And on Thursday, NPHET recommended another national tweak, only 6 people from one household allowed to visit. And if you're wondering why, well, maybe this scary, scary, scary example might help. Here's Dr. Breda Smith, Director of Public Health at HSE West.
A couple went on a week on a trip away. They arrived back on day one of the weekend and attended a house party. At this house party that they attended, there were 8 people, and 6 out of the 8 people became positive with COVID. They stayed overnight with a family, and in this household, 3 out of 4 of the household became positive, and also 3 further social contacts of the family became positive. One of the couple then, day 2 of the weekend, went with another group of friends for a dinner party. There was a table adjacent to that, and all 6 members of that adjacent table became positive, and also 4 staff. The index case with another friend then went to another drinks venue and to meet a party of 4 for drinks, and all 4 became positive.
Ooh, I wouldn't want to be that couple. But with COVID-19 likely to be with us for at least another 6 or 9 months, and frankly, that's optimistic, just how should we possibly go forward? Back to Mike Ryan of the WHO on Drive Time.
Without a vaccine, is there an end in sight to this?
There is no immediate end in sight. I mean, the disease continues to spread very efficiently. But what I will say, over the last 2 months, we've seen the trajectory of the pandemic globally has flattened. And in places like Africa, in places like South America, in fact, the numbers have started to drop. Mm-hmm. In Europe, we're now seeing this second phase of increase in intense transmission. So that situation is variable all over the world. But your question is well asked. Can we fully deal with this virus without a vaccine? I believe we can do much better. And I believe if you look at some of the countries in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific, this disease is controllable even without a vaccine. And in fact, when a vaccine does come along, if we have the disease under good control, then the vaccine will be much more useful and much more effective. We cannot rely on a vaccine to be our only salvation, because we don't know will it be effective.
And so does getting the COVID-19, the virus, under control, as you say, does that depend eventually on herd immunity? Or does a virus like COVID-19 eventually abate? Or is it the case that it mutates and continues?
Viruses like this, essentially, they're like a forest fire. They will burn every tree in the forest if they get that opportunity. And in that sense, every human being is potentially in the path of the virus. The what we can do is break those chains of transmission and reduce the opportunities for the virus to transmit to a minimum. And that's why the social distancing, the hand washing, wearing of masks, avoiding crowded spaces, we're reducing the opportunity of the disease to transmit. We may not get that fully under control by completely eradicated doing that. And that's what we hope a vaccine will bring, that extra tool, that extra bullet in our gun that will finally bring the disease fully under control. But there's a lot we can do before we get there. But I don't want people to leave and think that we're without hope. A lot. Look at countries like Korea. Look at countries like China. Look at countries like New Zealand, Australia and others. They have managed to bring the disease under some deal of control.
Mike Ryan of the WHO is heard on Drive Time, giving us a little bit of hope. Well, that is almost it for this week's playback, but we'll finish with a poem from Derek Mahon, whose death was announced yesterday at the age of 78. It's a poem that in these uncertain times has taken on a particular resonance. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Everything is going to be all right. Why should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, but there is no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds fly. Everything is going to be all right.